Good evening, America, and welcome to everyone listening across the planet. This is the Author and Artist Hour.
Sometimes I could go weeks without writing, but then when it came, it just hit me, and then I was like,
Excellent, excellent, and happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Oh, well, our Thanksgiving. Well, happy Thanksgiving every day, right?
That's right. That's right. It's a lovely tradition, Thomas. Isn't it? Right.
Thanksgiving everywhere else is in August, isn't it? September? Which one?
We don't have Thanksgiving, darling. Australians don't. But I do love the American tradition. Like, it's just a lovely tradition.
It is. It's my favorite day of the year.
All Americans say that, and I think it's a lovely addition to the pre-Christmas rush
and all the
rest of it.
I agree. Mm. Yeah.
Well,
we're going to be streaming live to your portals, and we'll be streaming it live to some of our portals. Can't be all of them because that's the other show. But we're also going to air it again, so you're going to get two kicks at this cat.
Thank you. Whenever you've got space.
You get two runs, and so you get a lot more coverage anyways.
Thank you.
I hope you have a fantastic program.
Thanks, Alan. Hey, TJ.
Hello. Sorry, I'm in
that talk. That's okay. Sound and light. I can hear Pat really wonderfully clearly.
Perfect. Thank you.
You both sound fine. I'm looking at the wavelength right here. Woo-hoo! You both are pretty even. And then your lighting looks great. I can see you both very clearly.
Thank Fantastic. I like to be completely organized and I have things all sorted out. But anyway, yes, you've got new intros.
I walk into my room and my room's a tornado went off. I want to pick it up, but then I look at it. It's too much work. I'm kind of lazy.
Yep.
Get like a hint of an anxiety just looking at it, making sure I want to have it all organized and everything.
Yep, that hint of anxiety. That is my AI that takes notes for me, that makes sure we have the transcript of the show sooner rather than later. So I did not realize that it was going to join. So I hope that's okay, TJ.
No, that's fine. I just didn't know what it was. That's cool.
Yeah, no, it's a little AI tool that I'm testing that will do the show notes for me. Fingers crossed.
Nice.
Oh, wait, I just realized. So this is the Author and Artist Hour, correct?
Yes.
I don't have a new banner for it, so it's still showing Kez. Is that bad?
Renee just sent the new ones.
She did. Okay, then give me just a moment. Let me go grab those.
Okay.
But I do have the new intro.
Good. Excellent.
I'll be right
back. If you've got the good new intro, that's fine.
Okay. I'll fix the banner then, I guess, next week. Is this going to be a recurring show for a few weeks or just once today?
It's just one special show for Patrick.
Okay. Thank you.
I need to have a break and then come back organized for next year, so that's what I'll do. But this is a special show specifically for Patrick in the lead up to the launch for his book.
I see. All right, well, I'm excited to hear it. We've still got about a minute and a half. I'll be right back.
Okay,
thank you, Tony, very much.
Normally it's such smooth sailing. We jump on at 10 to the hour. TJ's there. He checks your sound. He checks your lighting. We say good day. We go live to air and it all runs really smoothly.
Oh, that's okay.
I'm so sorry, but this will be good though. You'll get more plays of this. And I'll also run it through my channels in the lead up to your launch.
Thank you.
Yay!
Here we are. Excellent.
Excellent. Now, let me just have a quick look and let me snooze this and let me stop that and close down that. Got to remember to close all your tabs down while you're live streaming, because it doesn't always have an impact, but there's just sometimes it does. So
close some of my tabs as well. Save as much bandwidth as we humanly possibly can.
I know. Hey, is it getting cooler over there, Pat?
I was actually in Washington, D.C. this morning, and it was 20. Yes. I'm in California now. I flew back this afternoon to be on the show tonight. But I was in D.C. this morning, and it was 20 degrees, which was really cold. But in California, we're in the 70s. So, yeah, it was a little bit of a skin shock to be there for the week.
I was going to say, that's a bit of a shocking change in temperatures for you.
Yes, in 5 hours, you go from 20 degrees to 70. So when I landed in San Diego, it was really nice. And when I left D.C., it was 20. So, no, I'm glad to be home for sure.
Oh, so it's a five-hour flight, Patrick?
Yes, 5.5 from D.C. to East Coast to West Coast is 5.5 hours.
Yeah, that's not long, is it? It's actually longer to do East Coast, West Coast in Australia.
I'm sure it's what, 10 hours or 9 hours or something like that?
Six and a half, seven, depending. Oh, sometimes you can get a 6 hour nonstop. Okay. Just depends which airline. But usually it's more 7 or 8 hours because of where you've got to fly to get from the East Coast to West Coast. So
if you do Perth to Melbourne, that's 6.5 hours. Okay.
Yes.
All right, I'm back. And if everybody's ready, we're good to go.
Woo-hoo!
I wasn't able to find the new banner. I'm sorry. I didn't see it in the email. I saw your email.
That's okay.
But
that's okay. It'll be from Renee if you're looking for it.
Renee? Okay, I'll have to look again. But
that's okay.
On that note, is everybody ready?
Yes, let's do this.
Perfect. Then we're going live here in 5, 4, 3, 2. Have a great show, you both. Here we go.
Good evening, America, and welcome to everyone listening across the planet. This is the Author and Artist Hour.
We just flowed. I mean, I could go write 10 poems a day sometimes. Sometimes I could go weeks without writing, but then when I came, it just hit me and that was like,
welcome back to the show. This is the Artist and Author Hour, and I'm your host, Tony Londis. And yet again today, we have an amazing guest to talk to you, and he is launching a fabulous new book in December. But before I introduce you to our wonderful guest, here's what you need to know. If you're listening live on Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, Everyday Women's Network, or anywhere else where you see this show, don't forget to like and subscribe, particularly if you're watching on YouTube. We love our subscribers. The other thing I want you to know is anything that we talk about today, any information you want to know about our guests will be attached to the show. So just look at the show and you will find show notes accordingly attached. I encourage you, if you miss any replays of the show or you want to catch up on any of the shows across our platforms, please have a look at Tony TV on Binge Networks, Hero Go, Pad TV, and of course the Tony TV channel app available on Android, Apple, LG, Samsung, Roku, Amazon Fire, and everywhere else. And of course the podcast is available across the planet. Now, each and every week, we do a beautiful tradition, which we started in 2022, and it's called A Welcome to Country, and it's Australia's recognition of the special and important role our Indigenous people play in our country's cultural identity. So today, I want to respectfully acknowledge the people of the Yugambeh language region on the Gold Coast, Queensland, Australia, the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, and I want to pay my respect to the elders past, present, and emerging, and all Torres Strait Islander and Aboriginal peoples listening here or watching today. So today we're going to talk about a wonderful new book called Sunrise in Saigon, a novel for our lifetime. Now, before I introduce you, here's what you need to know about the amazing Patrick Greenwood. Patrick, after military service, embarks on a 25-year career in information technology, working in various roles, including sales, engineering, support, and design. Many of his inspirations for writing came from his business travels across Vietnam, China, Japan, Taiwan, and Portugal. A true believer in listening to one's passion, Patrick started writing early in 2020 based on several trips that he'd done cycling in various countries. His novel, Sunrise in Saigon, Patrick draws upon several non-fictional events rather that happened in Vietnam, including the war with the US, the last days of Saigon falling, and the chaos in and around the US embassy at that time. He remembered these events as a young man and grew up wanting someday to travel back to Vietnam and visit these places himself. In 2012, Patrick did return to Vietnam and found the lost US embassy and the Catholic nuns that helped with Operation Baby Lift. Patrick followed his passion for cycling by completing several bike tours in Ho Chi Minh City and the Mekong Delta regions. Patrick is the holder of a bachelor in and an MBA in global marketing, along with completing several postgraduate certificate programs in information security, the Internet of Things, and global management from MIT. Patrick is married and resides in Carlsbad, California, and I am so delighted to have Patrick on the show today. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thank you so much, Tony, for having me. That was a great introduction. I really appreciate it. But thank you so much for having me.
I'm delighted to be talking to you. So Vietnam is actually one of the places that I've been to a number of times. And it has special memories for me, both around the atrocities of war and the history of the Vietnam War, and then around the people and the food. Vietnam is just, it's a wonderful place to visit. It's a wonderful place to tour. And I'm glad that I get to share these memories and your memories with our audience today. Now, one of your favorite quotes is, "Happiness is not a commodity in life." Can you tell us about that, Patrick?
Well, that actually was part of the motivation of the book. Many times when people are writing historical fictional novels that are inspired by true events, which is how this book was written, it does talk a lot about how people really try to seek happiness. And when they finally achieve it, they either take it for granted, they don't really appreciate it enough, or they realize, I need to cherish this moment. I need to take this as a very special moment. Because many times in life, we do have, you know, gaps in time where we're not happy. And sometimes we should be taking journeys. And part of the motivation of the book was to really take that journey from inside, that desire to go somewhere. Like you've made a trip to Vietnam several times. Yes. So you've had the chance to see the people there. And I think one of the motivations of the book was really to kind of share a little bit of the history of Vietnam, share what has happened after the war. What are the people like? And then, of course, what are the people like that actually left Vietnam that went to other countries? So we have a lot of Vietnamese communities here in America as well. And I do touch on some of the interesting things about knowing many of them here as well. But it does really kind of tie to the point of happiness and really what, you know, what the main character, Jack Kendall, in the book really did to try to get that happiness in his heart.
Yeah, the Vietnamese people are generally very happy people as well. That's been my experience, because not only have I visited a number of times, I've volunteered in the hospitals in and around Ho Chi Minh as well. Beautiful, happy people, and with not very much.
Very, very pleasant. I was very happily surprised in 2012. But I had a lot of wonderful experiences here in America with Vietnamese people going back to my teens. I had the opportunity when I was attending college in Northern Virginia that had a very large Vietnamese community. And being a, you know, a young man and obviously struggling a little bit in calculus, among other courses.
Oh, calculus. But,
you know, yeah, but you select your pain in life, right? So I was working at the time at the George Mason University in Northern Virginia, and I was struggling in the library, and I was sitting at a desk and trying to figure out this formula, and just it wasn't there. And this wonderful young lady came over and said, "Don't give up." And she sat down next to me, and she actually helped me figure out the formula of derivative. And I kind of looked at her and said, "Hey, my name is, you know, my name Patrick Greenwood. Very nice to meet you." She goes, "I'm Nguyen Tran." I'm like, "Oh, where are you from?" She goes, "I'm from Vietnam." And then she introduced me to a lot of her friends that were in a study group that I ended up joining. So the openness, if you know that many of these people went through so much pain, so much struggle for many years, the kindness in them and the thoughtfulness of them has definitely came through. And I never forget that moment of somebody out of nowhere just sat down to try to help me out of the blue. And I never forgot that.
Yeah. Patrick, let's talk about Vietnam and the Vietnam War. How has your experience in the Vietnam War as a young man impacted on your life?
Well, first of all, I was born in 64 when it started. And so I remember, you know, being as young as 4 years old and remembering seeing bits and pieces of it on television, of course. But really, when we started getting into 1969 and 1970, when you had more and more people getting drafted, and then you had a lot of people coming back. And obviously, a lot of the soldiers coming back were treated incredibly poorly, not only by the people, but by the government and other people as well. But to really understand Vietnam really took shape for me when I was about 8, when you started seeing, you know, the bombings, and then you started seeing the peace talks starting in Paris. But it wasn't until I was 11, and I remember listening to the radio, and this actually, I captured this in the book as well. Mm-hmm. I remember listening to the radio on April 30th of 1975 when Saigon fell, and how it was like, we interrupt this broadcast to inform you that Saigon has now fallen. Mm-hmm. And it kind of the announcer said, and thank God, right, it's finally over. And a lot of us were still trying to figure out exactly where this was in the map, right? Where was this geographically and why were we there? And you know, I scoured through the Washington Post and all the newspapers looking for, you know, what's going to happen from here. And what really caught my eye was the Catholic nuns in Operation Baby Lift, where they made an attempt to try to get the orphans out. And President Ford at the time was behind it, and how the first plane crashed and the second one managed to get out. But I always was intrigued, being raised Catholic, like, whatever happened to those nuns? Why didn't they get out? They could have been on a transport. The Vatican could have gotten them out, or somebody could have gotten them out, but they didn't leave. And that was really, that was that driven desire in my heart as a person to say, God, I really someday, you know, would like to go there. So I was in the military in the 1980s, and I was stationed in the Far East as well. And, you know, there was never an opportunity to go to Vietnam because it was still in turmoil. But you would see a lot of refugees coming into the Philippines, into Thailand, and into other countries, Australia, of course, and
United States.
And asking them, you know, what do you need? Are you okay? And they always had this incredible, gentle smile to them. And it was just like, no, we're fine. Yeah, we have some food, please, but we're fine. And they held their families together. They're very family-oriented. So the grandmas, the aunts, the uncles, the nephews, and nieces, everybody was together helping each other. And I thought I was really moved by that there was so much family camaraderie as well. And that really was another big part of my desire at some point to go to Vietnam in 2012, was I really needed to see this. I really wanted to, I've worked with Vietnamese coworkers for years. They work in technology for years. I've been in cyber for years, but never said to myself, okay, now it's time to just pack it up and go. And in 2012, I made that trip.
Yeah. Patrick, your recollections of the war may be different from the historical accounts. And the reason I'm wanting to explore this question was, I know from my own perspective, when I actually went to Ho Chi Minh, or Saigon as it used to be called, the war museum in Ho Chi Minh City is one of the places in all of my travels that I remember very distinctly and very clearly. It had a physical and spiritual impact on me going through that museum. So I'm really curious to explore if you've been there, what you felt, and how your childhood recollection differed from the historical accounts and your visits to Vietnam.
I did have a chance to go to that museum as well in Saigon, and I did see the planes out in front, and I did walk through it. Obviously, being an American, there was always so much mystery behind the war, even though it was on the news, it was in the papers. But from a perspective, until you actually physically go to Vietnam and actually see the buildings, the post office, the Notre Dame Cathedral, and obviously the presidential palace, you don't really have a perspective. And so when I was walking through the museum, it was more about, not so much about feeling pain or feeling sorrow. It was more like, oh, really? That really is exactly the way it happened. I really was not moved, Tony, until I took the tour of the presidential palace across the way.
Yes, and you
see the tanks that actually went through. Now, I covered this in the book a little bit as well, but there's a scene in which in the book that I covered that where the tanks came through the fence and broke the fence down, those soldiers led the president out of the building. When I was there in 2012 and I went there, the actual tank crews were still there. They reported to duty 25 years later, every day, like it was yesterday. Yeah. And I didn't know that until I did the tour and I went around and saw everything and went down to the basement and saw where the president was trying to escape. And I ran into this man, and he was one of the tour guides. And I said, is this where the president was taken out? He goes, oh, yes. And he pointed to these four gentlemen and says, they were the original tank crew. And I'm like, so I walked over and I walked over to him and actually saluted them, because I was ex-officer as well. And I kind of looked at them and I asked through my translator who was traveling with me, could you please ask them why they do this? As they felt it's their duty to still report for duty every single day. So even after the war was over, they still had that commitment to protect the palace. And so that was really very moving. And then when I was looking at the pictures on the walls and seeing, and I saw that they were leading the president. I saw it in Time magazine as a kid, leading the president outside the palace. Yes. The man that let him out was the tour guide that told me to talk to the tank guys. I went back to him and go, Patrick, are you the guy? And he's like, so the commitment, the pride that they take. And so the translator I had with me, the young lady was actually Vietnamese as well. She was actually from the local village and she's never been there. She grew up in a coffee farm. So she's never been to the palace before. So she's thanking me, saying, I have so much pride.
It's pretty special.
Yeah. And it was just special. So knowing that once you shed the war element and get into people to people meeting and communicating, it really was very profound. But at the same time, I felt for them. I've been to the War Memorial in Washington, D.C. on the American side, and you've seen all 58,000 names that are on the wall. But when you understand the Vietnamese side of it, it was 3 million people that passed away in the war. So it's amazing to see that they had...
Gives a different perspective, doesn't it, Patrick?
And the people were very nice. Even the military that was mining the streets that were directing traffic were like...
Correct.
They're like this. And I'm like, whoa, cool. Mm-hmm. but it was astounding. But no, I really think that... It was interesting, and I finally found out why they felt that way. And my translator told me in a very, very interesting way. She says, on that day is our unification. North unified the South, South unified the North. Now, granted, there was a lot of ugliness afterwards. This was no roses and parades. But the reality, though, is that the country did unify. It took several years to get it together. And then you look at it in modern day time.
They've done well.
Exactly. So it did bring an end to a war. Now, why this was so important in modern time is this war ended, period. It ended. Yes. Now, if you look at Afghanistan and Iraq and you look at Syria, they never ended. They kept going. So the idea of having something end and having a new beginning is why the Vietnamese people celebrate that April 30th as their kind of
as they should. Patrick, did you have the opportunity to visit any of the tunnels? I'm thinking specifically on the tunnels of Long Tan because of the Australian connection to those particular tunnels. But, oh, my goodness, they were so tiny, and it was mind-blowing to think that the war was, going on around and above them, and they were in these tiny claustrophobic tunnels.
I did go into the Chu Chi Tunnel. I barely fit because I'm 6'1". I could barely fit, but I have seen pictures during my military time of studying the war, and definitely they had entire mini cities underneath, and they had operating rooms, and they moved between tunnels. But
fascinating.
It was really like a phenomenal, but it was something that our military wasn't prepared for. And among other things, a lot of things our military wasn't prepared for. But that was a big one, was understanding that this was their home territory. This was their turf. Yeah. They knew all trees. They knew where every hole was, every tunnel was. And our guys were like, well, wait a minute.
And you would have never known. You would have never known what was going on underground, because on the top of the ground, it just looked like just land. Yeah, land or orchards or what have you, rubber trees, et cetera.
I did get into one of the holes, but I had to stop because I was too big to get through.
They're tiny.
But
they're
I did take the flashlight and do this and kind of look around it as well.
Yeah. Now back to the book, Sunrise in Saigon. The characters of the book, Jack Kendall and Lin Nu, I hope I pronounced that correct, shed light on the toxicity that can exist in relationships in real life. I'm wondering, what's important and why was it important for you to write about these relationships in that way? And was it hard to write in such a way about those toxicities in those relationships?
Well, it's interesting that the book really, from a fictional perspective, really took an account two different lives that ended up being parallel, and that you had an older gentleman that was going through a very tragic of life in his own way. And then you had a younger young lady that also was having a very different, you know, tragic life as well through her married life. And by fate calling, they kind of came together for a very brief, you know, romantic time. And obviously, you know, the cover of the book really has a lot of symbol to it. So you can see the cover, obviously. But the Saigon River really was probably the most important part of understanding the story, was even though they shared a very brief love for each other and a very passionate love for a very short time. Throughout the entire book, they always had a river between them. They were trying to find ways to build bridges, say, look, we haven't seen each other in years. I have my married life, you have yours. I'm having my struggles, you're having your struggles. But they always had this goal at some point saying, we're going to find a way to come together. And it just never played out that way. But how each person went back to dealing with their life and how each of them went through their own, I don't want to say not recovery, but kind of went through their next rendition of life. Jack went one way, and Jack, you know, obviously had a conclusion and moved on in life. But Lynn also had to make the decision to stay or go. And in the book, of course, she made her decision, which she chose. And kind of even towards the very end, you're thinking, okay, they're gonna find a way to, you know, connect the dots. And that's what made the ending very exciting. But it did take me 2 weeks to write the ending, because a lot of MacBeta readers were like, well, maybe they shouldn't. And half said, no, maybe we shouldn't. And they shouldn't. Maybe. So anyway, when you read the book at the end, you'll realize you go, okay.
Yes, don't say, don't give away the ending.
That's the way it kind of played out. But the nice thing is that the storyline does show that even in human life, that even the most beautiful passionate moments doesn't always last. And for them, it started on 12/12 of 2012, which is once every 1,000 years. So obviously it was very special. But at the end, it was the, you know, in every relationship, whether it's a marital or post-marital or external marital affair, somebody moves away first. Somebody is the one to back away. And in this one, as you can tell, you know, Lynn was the one that was starting to back away a little bit sooner, while Jack was thinking, well, I could just build a bridge and we'll come over here and we'll do this. And it's like, well, wait a minute here. You know, I've got these responsibilities and so do you. But it was very challenging to, you know, to talk to people that have been through something similar to this, especially with such a large age difference. And many times it's, does it last a week? Does it last a weekend? Does it last 6 months? In this case, their relationship lasted close to almost 17 years. But after that moment of passion in life, it never was the same. So that's why the cover was so important, to know that there was always going to be that river between them.
Ah, so that's the significance of the cover. Was it an easy choice with that cover, Patrick?
So I actually shot the cover myself when I was there in 2012. Is actually a sunrise. I was staying in the Renaissance Hotel in District 1, and I was on the 18th floor. And I heard stories of the sunrise on the river is supposed to be incredible. The manager of the hotel told me coming in, you know, make sure you get up early to see the sunrise. So I actually got up before it was still dark, and I was kind of sitting by the window and had my phone camera, and I'm going, I see a boat going by, another boat going by. I see, you know, this going by. And then suddenly the sun started peering up, and I had my camera. Probably took about 7 or 8 shots. And I caught that shot. And then, of course, that became the cover.
Yeah. It's a beautiful shot, Patrick. Well done. So in talking about war, we can't not talk about the impacts of war. And I'm curious, those memories you had as a young man, and then when you went to Vietnam in 2012 and you've been back subsequently, what do you think were some of the things that were left behind, the scars, if you like, across the land and the people?
Honestly, I did not see very many scars. Everyone from the hotel workers, everybody from the people I invested in a water company at the time, for reasons. I was cycling around in Vietnam, as I mentioned in the book. You know, Jack was a big cyclist as well.
Yeah.
And I found a lot of children had darkened teeth, like virtually no teeth. And many of the outlying areas were drinking sugar. And so I stopped my cycling guide at the time and said, why are the children all missing teeth? He goes, well, they drink sugar. Not sugar water, sugar. They would just grind the sugar with rocks, and then whatever came out became their drink because they couldn't afford clean water. So I found somebody had kind of a water plant in one of the districts, and I went over and cycled near it. And then I said, hey, you know, tell me about how you're doing this. And he had three large reverse osmosis tanks set up. And I said, I really have to get behind this. So I actually invested in it to help him clean up his plant and deliver a much cheaper water solution. And we started handing out free cases of water around some of the outlying districts where there was a lot of deep poor people. And that really was one of the things that I found. Again, you mentioned scars. You know, they were very open to my help. There was no animosity towards, oh, you're an American, we don't trust you. Even though in the book, I do kind of...
That's good to know, though.
That in the book as well. There is, in the book, I do talk about the distrust and things. But in real life, I didn't see that when I was there. People were very open. I think a lot of people a lot of the younger generation do not remember the war. And a lot of the history books do not talk about the war. So when I was bringing up guns and bringing up, you know, when the Chinese invaded, they're all like, they don't remember because the government didn't teach that. So in a lot of ways, the younger generation was like, who were most of the hotel workers and were the younger crowd. They were like, you know, Americans, I see you guys on TV all the time. It's the older people.
Yeah.
Even the older people were just smiling and waving. So no, I didn't get any sense of animosity or any score. The scarring part, to your point, I think it's not so much the American size. It was the Cambodians. It was the Chinese. It was the economic problems. We were cycling in the Mekong River area, and I looked over this abandoned cannery factory that was downriver, and my cycling guy told me, he goes, well, actually, Taiwan built that, and they abandoned it. Now it's polluting the river. So those are the scars of today. It's the economy, it's the economic boom. It was the solar panel company, First Solar, closed their factory in Vietnam because they couldn't afford to build solar panels there. And that left a open space. So the scarring of today is the economic growth of the 2000s is the pain, not the war that ended back in 75 as much.
Yeah. That's actually really comforting to hear, Patrick, that your perspectives on that, because, you know, it would be good to know that countries come out the other side of war with some positivity versus the negativity that we tend to read about. So good to know that is your perspective. Now I want to touch back on the nuns and Operation Baby Lift and what you found out about that project and how it worked and how you found the nuns.
Well, the first, of course, that's a great question, Tony, because it really started when I was 11 and they had I guess it was on CBS News, had a piece of showing President Ford carrying a baby off a plane. And so I was intrigued by that going, okay, this, you know, this is not one of our most popular presidents. However, he has a soul. And so, and obviously he had a soul to believe in this. So he worked together with the Roman Catholic Church in America and then the diocese in Vietnam to say, what can we do to help get these children out? And that's where the Operation Baby Lift came from. Now, truth be told, the first plane was a disaster. It was a tragedy that the plane did not make it out, but the second plane did. And I think
a reason, Patrick, for that first plane was mechanical?
Mechanical, I think, yeah. And And then the second plane, and then the preceding planes got out, and over 1,500 orphans did get out. Now, which is not a lot, because there was a lot of mixed American babies left behind that were outcasts in society, as you know from the history books. Yes. But a good portion got out. The Catholic nuns were the ones that put them in the boxes, put them on the on the tarmac to help get them on the planes and everything. So when I went there, and as sort of my part of my desire to find out whatever happened to them, it took a little bit because, again, if you did a type in their version of Google, it was blocked by the firewall because that was an old history. It want the government doesn't share that. But if you find a way to get around it, like I did, you eventually find that they,
I was just going to say, Patrick, wouldn't it be the one to find the way around the firewall?
Yes, I know nothing of cybersecurity. I know nothing about cybersecurity. Nada. I don't hack anything. So I found a way to get around it. And then I found that they were in an orphanage north of the city. And there was a one of the hotel workers was Catholic as well. And I said, do you know this orphanage? You know this church? He goes, oh yeah, I go there every Sunday for mass. Take me with you. So we went there, and I asked her, I said, do you know about these nuns? She goes, no, but I know who to ask. So she asked one of the older nuns that were there, and she kind of pointed to the front of the building and said, oh, you've got to go to the front of the building and go through the big iron gates. And eventually, you know, I did, and we eventually found them, and we found four of them that were still alive. And that was just like
amazing.
Wow. So I do cover a lot of this in the book. Again, it's part of a there's some fiction to it, but the non-fictional event was I did find them, and I had spent about 2 or 3 hours with them. And now what was really interesting was that two of them spoke French. And so I had to remember high school French because I remember.
High school French is so different.
Well, but a lot of them were there when the French were there in the 50s. So two of the nuns were there. They were in their late 80s, and they spoke French, and then one spoke Vietnamese. And then my translator that was with me helped, you know, provide some context. But I had to speak some French, even though I know very little of it. I had enough to sort of get it going. But it was very interesting to hear the stories of, you know, what happened at the airport. They were there when the plane went down. They were there rushing to try to, you know, find what they could, who they could say. They loaded up the second planes. They kept running back and forth between the orphanage and the airport while the city's getting bombed and, you know, and tanks are coming in and everything. So they were incredibly brave women. But I waited till the very end to ask, why didn't you leave? Why didn't you get out? You had a chance to, you know, to hightail out on the last flight out. And they just said, no, no, the children got out. And come to find out, a lot of children didn't get out. And so they had to get all the children back to the orphanage. So there was an entire drama of loading them on school buses and everything, pull carts, anything and anything to get the children back into the orphanage area. And while they were doing that, North Vietnamese tanks were rolling right down. And the funny thing was, not funny, but the dramatic thing was, the tanks that were rolling down were the same tanks that turned left and went to the palace that broke through the gate. So there was this divine intervention of some form that happened. I cover this in the book as well about the divine intervention they experienced. But literally, they were literally in the streets with boxes of babies. And they looked up there and they saw the tanks coming. And then the tanks at the last moment veered and went down another road. And those are the tanks that ended up eventually, you know, at the palace. But really just having those moments and to actually walk on that road and see where this whole thing came out. It was dramatic. I was very emotional. I actually had a couple of rosaries from my grandmother that I carried with me, and I gave my rosaries to the nuns. I said, here's my gift to you for, because I've wanted to see them since I was 11. And obviously at that point, but really to witness that. And then on the way out, you know, when the iron doors closed and everything, and I was standing in the street with the translator, I had this really, I don't want to say difficult, but a very challenging sense of emptiness, because I've been waiting so long to find them that I finally did. And it took me a moment to get it together, because I really was emotional about, wow, it took you 11 to your 49, you know, to see this. And now what? So, and I knew at some point in life I'd have to write about it. And that's kind of what also why it made it into the book eventually.
Patrick, did you find out what happened to the babies? Did they go out over the globe? Did they just go back to the US? Did they go into further orphanages? What happened to the babies?
Initially went to Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, and then it eventually went to Medina Air Force Base in Okinawa. And then the babies, a lot of them were brought to America. Some were brought to Europe, and some were sent to Canada as well. And then they also had an idea of where the children end up. The really beautiful story was that the nuns told me is that many of the children have come back. And so they found a way to come back and find us. And they actually created a Facebook group and other social medias over the years too.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So the nuns did tell me that many of the children have found a way to come home. And they were just astounded. Now, obviously, they don't remember each other from a face-to-face perspective, but they remember the feeling. They remember the nuns explained to the children, hey, you all were just this big. We put you in little boxes. There was no way. There were some little, maybe 4 or 5 years old, maybe, but the most were very little, small children. And they explained the story of what happened that day. But they did tell me a few of them did make it home.
Oh, that's lovely. That's lovely. They're very special. The orphanages in Vietnam are very special places to visit because the children really are, you know, loved and protected as best they can with very little, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I do cover a piece in the book. I did bring up a non-fictional topic, but a fictional storyline on how many of the children are basically kind of adopted by countries that are wanting to raise the children to work in factories. And it's a controversial part of the book that I wrote that talked about, is this human smuggling or are they taking children off the street so they don't become adopted by the drug lords and they get put to work in a factory making Nike shoes somewhere in Pakistan. And I wrote that piece in the book, and a lot of the beta readers that kind of went through that kind of gave me, they gave me that kind of weird look. I said, but reality is that a lot of these development countries have challenges with
their children. Trafficked, yes.
Exactly.
Children and babies are trafficked.
Exactly.
Yes.
How do they cope with it? So I narrated a kind of a fictional storyline that it did take a few of the beta readers to read a few times. And then by the time they read it a third time, they went, right now I get it. It's either that or they would have been stolen and sold off versus somebody come and grab 20 of them, say, I'm going to put you in a place. I'm going to give you food, give you clothing, give you medical, and I'm going to teach you a skill. The skill is you're going to make Nike shoes. But the fact that you're no longer living on the streets anymore. Mm. So and that really does happen in a lot of these development countries. So I do have a piece of that in the book as well about how the children and some of the orphanages could not take care of all the children. Some did end up on the streets as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm guessing that there would not be as many orphaned babies and children now versus at wartime. But there's still those scenarios still happen, don't they? There's still a need for orphanages, particularly in poor countries like Vietnam.
There is. And, that's a great, great question, a great comment as well, Tony, because when you cycle through Ho Chi Minh City, which is Saigon, there is 13 districts. I cycled through 11 of them. So I know them pretty well.
And I was going to say, it's a big place.
It is. And then there's eight.
Big and bustling. Gosh, Patrick, I've just got an image of you knowing what the traffic's like and thinking, oh my goodness, how did you manage to cycle through that traffic safely?
Well, so I love cycling. As you can tell by my wall, I've cycled all over the world and everything. I love cycling. And I take it on the plane with me wherever I go. Cycling to me is one of my passions in life. And it always has been. It always is. What made it interesting about cycling in those districts, and it kind of brings to your point about orphanage and poverty, you could be cycling through District 1 and it looks like Singapore. High rises, condos, shopping malls, Starbucks. I was there when the McDonald's opened. I'm like, why? You got the best organic food in the world. Why are you eating this crap? Right. But they opened a McDonald's.
McDonald's is everywhere.
And there was a Taco Bell there and a KFC. I'm like, people, you're going to look like us in 20 years, right? So stay open junk food. Yes. But they were lining up for it. But what was interesting, though, by riding in District 1, to me, it looked like Singapore. And then you ride through District 5, and then you start to get to District 11, and suddenly you're thinking,
yes,
okay, that's that's poverty. That's poverty beyond poverty.
Yeah.
And District 13 was where the water district was that I invested in. So that was in an outlying area. And so there is a very, you can turn left by the market and now you're in a very, very challenging place. Children are living on the street. Two blocks away, they're driving a BMW they just imported. And you mentioned the traffic and the roads. There's 8 million people that live in Ho Chi Minh City. There's 13 million scooters because people have two at home. The roads are not made for scooters. They are not made for cars. And these children that dare to get on their bikes and cycle is like, they're like the bravest children alive.
Absolutely.
That's why the proceeds of my book and coffees are going to Helmets for Kids in Vietnam. So this is actually a helmet that is made in Vietnam. And I've actually, so the proceeds of my helmet are going to make these helmets. It got started in 2000 by President Bill Clinton when he was there visiting. And the organization to date has made almost 1 million helmets in 20 years. And they've distributed Vietnam, Thailand, India as well. And so to me, being a cyclist, obviously I saw firsthand, you know, the dangers of these kids. So when I started putting the book together, I then looked for a charity that I could align to. And that's when I got contacted to Helmets for Kids in Vietnam. So my proceeds, my book, my coffee and everything all goes to helping support the kids. But to see it firsthand, when you have five-year-olds that are dodging cyclists or the scooters and the cars, know, and just to see that tragedy. But there is good news that there is help. There is helmet laws in Vietnam now, which are helping it. And obviously having, you know, contributors like myself to help, you know, raise more money to make more helmets is a good thing as well.
Absolutely. I was going to say, Patrick, when I volunteered in the hospitals, the number one issue that they were dealing with was motorbike bike accidents, and they were just prolific. No helmets, you know, broken bones, legs, arms, all of that. So, it's a pretty important. And they never, none of them ever used to wear helmets at all, did they, in that traffic?
There's a law, thank God, completely scary.
Yes.
There's a law now. They have to wear it. But it's not for the cycles. It's for the motorbikes. So you can tell everybody that rides a bike.
You can still kill yourself on the bike. You can still, you can still kill yourself on a push bike just as much as on a motorbike. But yes, the thought of cycling through that city landscape, my goodness, Patrick, my goodness.
But it was good though. I mean, the good thing was, if you want to see it, and by the way, you may not be.
You can see it.
That's my jersey from Vietnam. It kind of has a little tagline saying, you know, see Vietnam from, you know, from behind the wheel. And really cycling there was the best way to see the country, see the people. Obviously, I got inspired to get involved in the water business. It inspired me to get into Helmets for Kids as well. But when you really come to the country and you see the openness of people and really kind of the warmth of it, even when I was like completely out of like no more energy whatsoever, and I'm on the side of the road, I was sitting down, I had nothing. An elderly gentleman came up and gave me a cup of tea. And I was so moved by that. And I was like, I kind of like, thank you. So I was sweating and I was, but to see that kindness is definitely, we need
They're
more of that.
Very beautiful. I'll say it again. They are the most beautiful people, truly just gorgeous human beings. Patrick, you're still involved with the water project in Vietnam?
No, I sold off in 2016, and truth to be told, it was open for a year. Actually, the factory was open longer than that, but my involvement was about a year. Yeah. It did really well from a standpoint of, we created new products. We actually, we lowered the cost of water so it could be affordable. We started giving away a lot of free water in jugs and sports bottles to local communities. And then any profits we made per month, we donated them to the Catholic nuns to help support the orphans. And we donated to some of the Buddhist temples as well. And we did that for about a year. Now, obviously, in a development country, not everybody plays fair. And it's more and more exposure you get, the more people come by going, gee, that's a little low. You haven't registered your vehicle yet. He doesn't have a license. We need to correct it. So after a few rounds of, donations to some local non-charitables, it finally got to the point where that became more dominant than the sale of the water. And so eventually I sold off my piece of it. We sold most of the factory to a scrapyard who ended up doing something with the metal as well. But everything I sold from the scraps, I divided between the temples and the Catholic nuns as well, and left and gave money to the workers as well, and thanked them for what they did. But for a good year, every month it was very good. Nice to see how many waters we were selling and how much donations we were giving to the causes.
Fantastic. Fantastic. The helmets for kids, was that something that you just stumbled upon by virtue of you cycling through Vietnam, or had you known about it before you went?
Didn't know. I didn't really know until 2019. So I started writing the book in 2019 and during COVIDism. And I was still working in technology at the time. And I really was getting kind of sick of working in technology. I was in it 27 years. And I said, you know what, time to shift gears and move left. So I started writing full time. And the first thing I did is I broke out the yellow note paper and I just started writing the book. And I was baiting on memory of trips and things. When the book got picked up by a publisher, it got picked up by Austin McCauley Publishers out of New York. I was obviously extremely thrilled to be signed as a writer. But the next thing I thought about was, okay, what else do you know, what do you really want to do with this? Where do you see this going? And I started researching on helmets for kids, and it brought up helmets for kids in Vietnam. And I did the whole background, and I realized that not only was President Clinton involved early on, but Senator John Kerry was involved. And then in 2018, the actress Michelle Yeoh became the global ambassador for the program. So that was like, okay, this is really sounds great. And of course I had a chance to meet the founder, Greg, before. And so it just seemed like this is a great organization.
It was good. Yeah.
So the first thing that came out was I started coming out with coffee mugs. So I like my coffee brand that I have and my logo, of course, as well. And at the bottom, you know, making, you know, espresso, you know, one espresso at a time. And then I released a coffee brand with different coffees. This is actually the one called obviously Sunrise and Saigon Coffee as well.
So I was going to ask you, how did you get into coffee? Yeah, but I'll do that in a minute.
so coffee was the first two products that I started selling. And then I've raised almost $1,800 so far since May. And I donated back to Helmets for Kids. Now with the book coming out on November 30th, the proceeds of the book as well. But I really wanted to start kind of getting the thing going. So the coffee mugs were first, then I had coffee second. And then now the book will be coming out as well. Yeah. And then the good thing is that since I donated some money, they've made almost 180 helmets so far. So, and that's May of this year. So my goal is to next year is to have 1,000 helmets made for the children. But yeah, I did some research. I was very pleased with the organization. They're a great group of people. I'm just very, very proud to be able to support them.
Oh, amazing. Amazing, Patrick. So do you think that you'll continue? I just had an idea then. You could almost do a cycling book tour, but then again, it's hard to transport the books on the bike. So you'd need a backup crew to transport the books with your biking, cycling book tour.
Well, that's kind of how that's how my logo came about. So on the book, that's what cycle writer. So it has the pen running through the bike. So, so actually I have 7 books total, and you kind of see on my shoulder, I've got the different covers of the other ones that are coming out. Yeah. My next one is due out next July, which is codenamed Dragon Vault. That's actually going to be a fictional novel as well. It's going to deal with Bitcoin hacking, kind of gets into my cyber background. Jack Kindle does survive, and he moves on to the.
That was my next question.
Linda's not. Lynn will not move on until book 6. He shows up later in Paris, but in the next book, it really goes more towards my cybersecurity and Bitcoin background as well, which obviously perfect timing with the way of the world right now. I do have a second one coming out next year. Now, I'm going to be using Helmets for Kids will always be tied to Sunrise and Saigon.
Sunrise and Saigon, yes.
Codenamed Dragon Vault is actually going to have a similar charity in Taiwan. So every book I'm writing, and then the one after
will go to a charity.
Exactly. So the third one is actually going to be over there, which is called Shores of Okinawa. That actually has a charity in Japan. So every book I've written is in a different country that has something to do with cycling, hacking.
Yes.
Point, right. So, but every one of the books will have a charity specific. So I'm looking for Helmets for Kids in Taiwan and one in China and then obviously one in Hungary as well. But as many books as Saigon are sold, the proceeds will always be going to the ones in Vietnam.
Fantastic, fantastic. Patrick, I'm curious to know what the process was to get your publisher on board. So how did that go for you? Did you pitch to them? Like, how did that work for you? Because all authors have a different publisher story. So I'm really curious about yours.
So it's a great question, because I've seen some of your other interviews as well, and everybody has a different perspective of a publisher. And many times it's foul language we can't say in television. But but many publishers, when I've sent query letters out, I got the usual rejection letters and things, and I didn't take it personally at all. But also Macaulay was coming out of I would say more of a controversial time. They were in 2015. They were labeled as a vanity. They had a lot of bad press coming out of the UK. And so when I talked to them in 2020, when they got my manuscript, you know, they showed up with, this is how much it's going to cost. And everyone said, whoa, if this is a legitimate publisher, you shouldn't be paying them, they should be paying you. But tragedy be spoken, you still have to hire an editor. You still have to pay for the cover. You still have to.
Books take a lot of money to get out of your head and into a physical book. Right. You know, the landscape of publishing has changed completely in the last few years. I actually think is quite a good thing, because it actually means that anyone out there listening can write a book and get it published by a publisher. And of course, we would all like big name publishers, but does it matter? Your book is being published. Yes. You have readers. Does it matter? Yeah.
Well, no, you hit it beautifully, dear, very much. It's about getting your book out. And so I looked at it as, okay, I still have to pay this money, because I need the hardback. I need obviously the paperback. I need an ebook, and I need an audible book. If you add up the cost of all four of those compared to what Austin Macaulay was going to charge, I said, okay, I'm going to go with them, because they're going to get the book out. Now, the good thing is, when I did my research with them after 2015 and you started looking at them in 2018-19, and I actually went and bought almost 40 of their books off their website, and I read all 40 of them, and I started looking at the quality of their work, going, you know what? Good quality, good editing, good covers, good legal work. You know, all the ISBN numbers were accurate. So everybody that in publishing was sort of like, oh no, you don't want a vanity. Well, wait a minute. They're not a vanity anymore. They actually became a full blown publishing house. And I've had an incredible experience with them over the last 2 years. They've been wonderful. The editing's been great. Communication is great. You know, right now we're talking marketing with them about, you know, what are we going to do, podcasts together? What are we going to do? Get ready for the big launch. But now the book is out, coming on November 30th. I got all the pre-copies shipped to me last week. I've got more coming.
Be exciting.
I'm beyond words. I got to deliver a copy to my mother over the weekend in DC. It was incredible. I signed it for her and everything. And so book one is out. Book one is hitting. Now the other four over here, I have to make a decision if I'm going to self-publish or am I going to work with Austin Macaulay. And I'm in conversations with them to say, look, I've got 7 books. I know you guys like doing one at a time, and I think I'm okay with that. But at the same time, you know, I want to make it look at the options. But to get your first book out, get it done with a professional firm, Austin Macaulay has been fantastic.
Yeah. And it's a big undertaking. I'm not sure that people realize that the time and energy that goes into writing a book and then all the processes along the way, it just never stops. So there's beta readers and there's editors. Then it gets close to the end and you'll go through and there'll be you'll find a missed capital or a misspelt word and it's back to the drawing board, and then there's the cover and the presentation and the fonts, and there's a lot involved in producing the formatting. The formatting drove me crazy, Patrick.
This is 285 pages. When I wrote this, it was 126,000 words, and I was thinking this was going to be thin. It wasn't going to be when this showed up last week. I'm like, so I was kind of blown away. But again, because they're pros, they know this has to fit on the bookshelf at Barnes and Noble. It's got to be through Amazon, and that's what you're paying for. So if someone came to me saying, "Should I trust them? They know what they're doing. You're going to get a finished product. Go buy some." I always tell writers, if you really want to see what it's like to work through them, go go on their website, buy a few books, you know, austinmccauley.com/UK. Go on there and buy some books and read them. And if you think the book is, then fine, move on. But they were very, very nice. Now, the funny thing was, after I signed with them and I started moving transcripts back and forth, the one challenging thing I always encourage people that are writers, have multiple people edit your book. Because
definitely, I did that too, Patrick. I had four, I think. I worked with one predominantly, and I picked her because of her background across psychology, writing, and editing. And then the others were, you know, structural edits, story, like there's whatever part of the book you can think of, there's an editor specifically for that. But it makes a difference to your book, doesn't it?
And don't pick people that love you. Pick people who don't even know you.
And that's what you want them to challenge you.
You want people to look at that going, look, I have no clue who you are, man. But and you want them to really come at it as hard as possible. Now, with that being said, I did have my own experiences with editors where they came back. Now, I'm dyslexic. I've been dyslexic since I was a child. Yes. So I was not built right, but I still am. Okay. Life is good.
I get that.
But to get the funny thing was, they would come back and say, oh, your prepositions were this. I go, I'm out. Did you get the story? Did you get Jack and Lynn doing the, you get it? Well, yeah, but let me get back to this. This preposition, I had to move your verbs over here. And I'm like, it's not fifth grade, lady. Drop the red pen, you know? And finally, it took me like 3 hours of just saying, look, you're not getting it. I want you to help me know that I structured this right. Did you read it?
Yes. Rest can come, can't it? You know,
sometimes editors can be the most finicky, but you need them. You need each other. You want to find product. But the point of the publisher is to have that fine end QA, that quality assurance at the end. And Austin did a phenomenal job on the QA. They came back multiple times, says, we're not getting the ending. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, why not? Well, we think you should end it this way. I said, no, it's got to end this way. And to be transparent, they were very cool about it eventually. Now, at the beginning, they wanted to really dictate the middle, the ending, you know, this should be this way because we think it'll sell. I go, yes, but it's not how the story should be. Uh-huh, and so as a writer, you still have to own the story.
You do. And you have to, and there's moments where you have to back yourself too, and actually push back and go, well, actually, no, this, you're taking it this way, and it's actually meant to go this way. So sometimes you have to, and it took me a long while, I must say, to grasp that I could push back and go, yeah, no, that's not the way I want to write this particular section of the book. It needs to actually be this, this, and this. So there's a whole lot of learning, isn't there, Patrick?
Well, I agree. And I saw one of your interviews you did with a gentleman that was very fascinating, that he talked about how he was thinking about, it wasn't about the publishing, it was about the continuum after the book was out. And one of the things I always talk to my fellow writers about, I also host a podcast as well. I host one on Saturdays called Writers.
Yes, I know. I had a look.
That's right. You do follow it.
I already checked that out.
Thank you. But on that podcast, to your point, I do talk to writers about their experiences, and always I tell them, you have to have a continuum. It isn't about the day the book comes out. It's about
a lot more afterwards.
Agree. Patrick. But what's your expectation? I interviewed a young lady a few weeks ago who wrote the book, you know, A Place to Take Root. She was a wonderful Korean student. And I've known her personally on a personal level. And I always asked her, what's your continuum? What's your plan after the book release? And she's like, I'm going to go on vacation. I go, it's not the continuum. As a writer, I always encourage writers to think about, is your expectation to be John Grisham, or is your expectation to have the book come out and know that you can respect your own story? And you have to remember that when you look at the book sales and you're only sold 10, you thought you sold 100 or whatever, and you're starting to stress going, no one ever read my book. You did. You read it.
That's the thing that matters the most. You wrote it. You read it. It's done. And yes, it would be wonderful for all of us to be international bestsellers, but that doesn't always happen. And you have to actually, you're right, Patrick, you actually have to think about that. What's next? I've just glanced down at the time and thought, oh my goodness, I've had so much fun talking to Patrick. I'm completely out of time. And we need to talk about quickly the launch date, where they can get the book, and the proceeds of the book. One last time, go, Patrick.
Absolutely. So the book is launching on November 30th. You can go to sunriseinsaigonnovel.net and buy it there. You can do a pre-order today. I do have a pre-order link that you can order. And this weekend, because this is Flash Friday and Cyber Monday, 35% off all paperback as well. All proceeds of the book and the coffees are going to Helmets for Kids in Vietnam. I have a little video up on my YouTube channel as well that shows it. But no, I love being on the show.
And we have the links in the attached to the talking points today. Otherwise, just type in Sunrise in Saigon in a Google search and it will go directly back.
No, your Sunrise in Saigon novel, and it'll take you right to novel.net. And that's the website. There's a pre-order button available today. You can order the book.
All proceeds. Please do.
Oh, no, please. It's a great book. A lot of fun. It was great writing it. But I have to tell you, Tony, I'm a huge fan of you. And I thank you for having me on your show. And this is a great. I know we've been working on getting on this show for a while. Thank you for having
me. My pleasure. I'm so glad it's finally at this point for you. But I actually know that there'll be so much more for you. Patrick Greenwood, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I can't wait till we chat again soon. Bye for now, everyone. Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks for having me.
Good evening, America, and welcome to everyone listening across the planet. This is the Author and Artist Hour.
It just flowed. I mean, I could go write 10 poems a day sometimes. Sometimes I could go weeks without writing, but then when I came, it just hit me and then I was like,
you guys are off the air. Fantastic show today, guys. That was awesome. I had a lot of fun.
Cheek, we started talking and I'm like, oh, that's good. That's fantastic. Well done. Great job. Thanks, PJ.
Thank you, TJ.
Thank you both. And thanks for sharing your story. I had a lot of fun listening to you guys today.
I know. We have fun interviews on this show. Patrick, I look forward to talking to you again, particularly perhaps in the new year, just to see how you're going, number one. And number two, just to see how the next books are coming along, because it's wonderful to actually talk from that perspective of what it was to like to write and the publishing. Like, people are very interested in that. And yes, we do need to talk about this conversation between traditional publishers and vanity publishers and what that means. And yeah, it's awesome.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Tony. You should come on my podcast sometime. I'd love to have you on my
Absolutely.
Side. I would love to have
Just
you. You're wonderful.
Email
You're
me.
You're incredible.
Oh, those words are so kind. Thank you, Patrick. It's been one hell of a year, let me say. A few too many challenges in 2022, so I'm excitedly looking forward to 2023. And yes, please reach out. I will come and do your podcast anytime you want me to.
Thank you, dear. And I hope you feel better, right, dear. Well, get some rest over Christmas, okay?
I will, I promise. TJ, thank you, darling.
Thanks, TJ.
Thank you so much. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving,
bye,
Patrick.
Guys.
And then
bye, guys.
Hope you have
happy Thanksgiving, guys.
Thank you, dear. You the same as well.
Okay.
Hope you have a great normal Thursday.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I hope you get a lot of rest and a good time during your holiday.
I will. I'm going to, like I said to Dad, I'm going to plan out. I'm going to do this show. I'm going to have a look at the time slot and go, I think I'll do it on that day. I'll do this. Yeah, I think that's the way I'll do it in 2023.
Sounds good. I look forward to it.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks, TJ. Take care.
Thank you, Tony. It's been a pleasure talking to you again.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.